This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome to the big picture for this week, everybody. You know, markets always seem to be concerned with the latest crisis du jour. And of course, I'm sure you've been watching. The latest one involves Deutsche Bank in Germany. And a lot of the market is concerned about the solvency of Deutsche Bank. Hedge funds have taken short positions in that institution. And the real question, is there a parallel to Lehman Brothers back in 2008? And if so, how would that affect the world markets? But that's our first topic here today on the program.
Well, I mean, you could say there are a lot of parallels to, let's say, Lehman Brothers, John, but there's a little bit of difference here, which we're going to get into because, I mean, Lehman failed the way all banks failed. It simply ran out of cash and liquid assets that could quickly be liquidated to sell to either pay their counterparties or their clients who were taking money out of the bank. So a lot of the market, and this is why we saw the big sell-off on Thursday and a rally on Friday over Deutsche Bank, because it's sort of the market's conclusion. Look, they got the ECB, and if there really is an issue here, we'll get into it in just a moment. It's a little dissimilar than to Lehman, even though there might be some parallels that somebody might draw. But the market is basically saying, is this another Lehman moment? Well, number one, Deutsche Bank is more diversified. Its liquidity position, it has $247 billion in liquid assets, equal to 12% of its total assets, versus, for example, at Lehman. Lehman only had $45 billion. And one thing I think central banks learned from Lehman is you cannot have somebody that is so interconnected, especially in the derivative market, and let them go under. And, you know, the one problem that we had with Lehman is the Fed basically denied them access to credit and liquidity. And so when Lehman went under, it triggered a daisy chain of events that went from one institution to another. And a lot of the rally that we're seeing in the market on Friday is, hey, worst comes to worst, Deutsche Bank would have access to the ECB. So the risk here is really to shareholders, because Deutsche Bank may end up, because of losses, withdrawals, may have to tap the equity markets, meaning that they would have to issue a large amount of shares to rebuild their balance sheet. And of course, what does that do to you if you're an existing shareholder? It dilutes you. And the reason that people are concerned about that, as a result of their problems, as a result of a short position, the high in Deutsche Bank was reached in October of last year when it was basically about 28 euros. And the low was reached on this Friday where it got down to an intraday low of 990 euros. And so you're talking about, now the stock closed 11.57. It was up 6.4% for the day, but from its high reached last October around this time in the last 52 weeks, the stock is down or got down as much as 65%. So if you are a shareholder and your stock is down 65% and they have to go out and do a large equity raise, 5, 10, 15, 20 billion, whatever it is, then they are issuing a lot more shares at a lower price. And so the thing that happens is the stock has gotten hammered. And so if you're a shareholder, you don't want to be diluted, especially at this price. If the company had, ideally, to raise capital, you'd want to see the share price up at a higher level, which means less dilution. So when we take a look at one of the reasons why we've seen the stock drop precipitously in probably the last 10 days is something, when you talk about the utilization of shares, the share short position is about 10% of total outstanding shares. So once again, the risk here is to shareholders. And what we've seen happen with Deutsche Bank, as we saw happen with Lehman and other firms that got themselves into financial trouble, once word is out on the street, you've had a lot of hedge funds that have pulled their book out of Deutsche Bank. They've transferred their derivative accounts to other players. And We'll talk about that in a minute and the risk that they are facing even doing that. But they're pulling money out. And it's like all banks fail for the very same reason. They run out of cash and liquid assets. But in this case, where Lehman only had $45 billion, you take a look at Deutsche Bank, they're about almost $250 billion of liquid reserves, or 12% of their assets. So this is not another Lehman until we talk about another aspect of Deutsche Bank, which will relate to other existing banks that are out there. So we've had many, John, as you pointed out, we've had many Lehman moments, not just in the last decade in the financial crisis. We've had them in every single decade. I can't think of any decade in my financial career that we haven't had a major bank go under. So the problem is these events are becoming more frequent.
Why are these events becoming more frequent? Just zoom back over the last decade. We had the major crisis, 2007, 2008. We also had the big crisis in Europe, remember? We had the crisis in Japan. We just seem to bounce from crisis to crisis.
Well, I think there's a number of issues that are coming to bear here. If we step back and take a look at a bigger picture, the world is over-leveraged and it's over-regulated. If we look at the financial system, we've seen incessant growth of debt, both here in the U.S. and global. The derivative market today is about $650 trillion, and that's trillion with a capital T. The other issue that we have is debt is growing faster than GDP, and that's occurring here in the United States as well as other countries. I mean, we have an $18 trillion economy, and we now have a $60 trillion debt balance, and globally, since the financial crisis ended, from 2008 to 2015, global debt has grown from $57 trillion to $200 trillion.
Isn't one of the issues, though, that we're facing here with this the derivatives exposure? Because we had a case where J.P. Morgan, remember, lost quite a bit of money due to a derivative thing that went south.
Well, and that's the real issue here. I mean, if you take a look at leverage ratios, which is debt to equity, it doesn't look that bad. However, if you look at equity versus the derivative exposure held by the bank, then it becomes a much more different situation. I mean, J.P. Morgan, these are 2015 figures, but J.P. Morgan, they had $232 billion in shareholder equity, $2.6 trillion in assets, but they had almost $64 billion in derivatives, a ratio of equity to derivatives of 275 times. You take Citibank, they had $210 billion in equity, $1.8 trillion in assets, and $56 trillion in derivatives. That's 267 times leverage. Goldman Sachs, $83 billion in assets and equity, $856 billion in assets, and $47 trillion in derivatives. That's a leverage of 565 times. Bank of America, $244 billion in equity, $2.1 trillion in assets, and $37 trillion in derivatives, a leverage ratio of 151. Now let's talk about Deutsche Bank. If you look at Deutsche Bank's liabilities, meaning the money they owe depositors and other people, compared to their assets, they're only leveraged 25-1. But if you look at their equity, which is $68 billion, they have a derivative book of $46 trillion, which is a leverage ratio of 676 times. So the risk here is counterparty risk. And we did a show on derivatives. I think it was before we went on or after we came back from our August recess, John. And the problem is everybody says, well, it's if you take the net position on derivatives, it's really not that big. It's maybe only $18, $19, $20 trillion. Well, that's not really a good way to look at it because the system is so integrated and globally connected. You're talking about a handful of players when it comes to derivatives. There are really basically about 10 to 12 banks that own about 90-something percent of the derivative market. And here in the United States, we have about 4 banks that own the majority of the derivatives. I think we have a total of over $200 trillion in derivatives just tied up in our top 4 or 5 banks. But here's the problem. And I always like to use this illustration. Let's make this simple math. I have a $100 million long position in the market. It could be in stocks. It could be in bonds. It could be interest rate futures, commodity. It doesn't matter what it is. I have a long position of $100 million. I'm not really sure about that long position, so I'm going to hedge myself. So I may have a $80 million short position that offsets my $100 million long position. So my net-net is I'm only exposed to, let's say, $20 million. But here's the problem. My $80 million in short position that's hedging my overall portfolio is depending on the solvency of those who I've hedged with. And that's the problem that you have in the derivative market. You've got about 10 major players that control the entire market. So one of them goes bad, it affects everybody else. So you may have a hedge fund that says, all right, I'm pulling out of Deutsche Bank, pulling our derivative book because we don't trust these guys. I'm going to go to somebody else. But the somebody else they go to is probably tied to Deutsche Bank. So it's really the notional value of derivatives, not just the netting position. And the only thing that we can say with certainty, in the event of a financial crisis, a significant number of counterparties to these derivative contracts will not be in a position to meet their obligations. And what we'll see is what we saw in 2008, a triggering, a daisy chain of defaults, which could threaten the solvency of the global financial system. Let's not forget, in 2008, first thing that Congress did, $800 billion loan to the financial system, the 25 top banks. Let's not forget, as it came out later in the Bloomberg lawsuit, that the Fed backstopped $9 trillion of financial assets, everything from deposits and money market funds to the commercial paper market to the financial system itself to also foreign banks who also had dollar exposure as well. So what is important here is, like anything else, this is all a confidence game. And what you were seeing happen to Deutsche Bank is word on the street was they were having financial problems. They have a lawsuit with the Justice Department that is demanding $14 billion penalty, which Deutsche Bank says it's going to contest. So when word gets out on the street, what do you, think of it this way. If you had money on deposit at your local bank and the newspapers, or you read on the evening news that bank was in trouble, what do you think you would probably do with your deposit?
Well, the odds are you'd move it somewhere else if you thought your money was going to be endangered. That's the natural reflex, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're seeing happening with large hedge funds and large institutions with Deutsche Bank now. And every crisis, banking crisis, ends up being a cash and liquidity crisis. Once you learn you run out of assets you can sell to raise cash to meet withdrawals, that's when game is over. And that's where central banks come in and inject liquidity so that the bank has the cash to meet its withdrawal. That was something the Fed did not do with Lehman, which was a big, big policy mistake. Hopefully, central banks have learned their lesson that you can't let that happen, because once the daisy chain starts, it's like a nuclear detonation, and they can't afford to do that. And we'll get into policy mistakes here that the Fed may be heading into one with its insistence on raising interest rates because of what happens to the dollar, what happens to emerging markets, what happens to foreign currencies. So it's not an easy academic study, and they are creating a policy uncertainty here, because what do we talk about? Are they going to raise or are they not going to raise? Well, six times they haven't raised. Now the speculation is they're going to raise in December. So we're still talking about it. And if they raise, I think they're going to be surprised, as they were last December. That little quarter point drove credit spreads up by 200 and 300 basis points, or 3 full percentage points, in the corporate market, especially in the junk bond market. Junk bond yields rose rapidly to 10%. You saw foreign currencies crash, the stock market crash, commodities crash. So, John, you know, they were somewhat puzzled, I think, by this quarter point increment had such a great impact on global markets. So it really gets down to what will cause the next crisis. Well, I think it'll be the same as the last crisis, and that is a loss in confidence in the system in central bankers. And once that confidence is lost, as we saw in 2008, it began in 2007 with the mortgage crisis. It began at Bear Stearns, and it just began to trigger one event after another. So a lot of people are saying, is Deutsche Bank the canary in the coal mine? And so that's why this is a very delicate issue, and you really have to be careful. I mean, as Greg Weldon and I talked about on the show last week, I would not want the job of being a central banker today, because they face a different world that is a lot more leveraged than it was in 2008. As I mentioned, global debt is gone up to over $200 trillion. U.S. debt is $60 trillion. That's a lot of money. So the problems we face right now is an over-leveraged financial system. It hasn't collapsed because interest rates are at zero, or in fact, many cases, negative percent. I mean, if you are a European bank right now, you can go to the ECB. They will loan you money and pay you for it. So imagine, John, you go into your bank and you say, you know, I need to borrow money to, do a home addition. It's going to cost $100,000. And your bank says, John, we're going to give you $100,000 and we're going to pay you 5% interest to borrow that money from us. I think we'd all be lining up at the bank teller window. So we have a world that where this leverage exists today. And the reason it exists, as we have pointed out here, the U.S. is sitting, and we'll get the figures here shortly in about another 6 weeks. The government fiscal year ends today. It ends September 30th for 2016. But in 2015, the government ended up paying $50 billion less in interest, even though it had $8.6 trillion more in debt. So we have an over-leveraged system. It hasn't collapsed because our governments and our debtors are looking at the lowest interest rate we've had in human recorded history. The other thing that has come into play as a result of the financial crisis is the global system is less liquid due to regulation. You've had a lot of major players in the bond market, especially the sovereign bond market, U.S. banks, pulled out of the system because of regulation. So it doesn't take much to move the global bond markets very quickly. I mean, we're all used to focusing on the, let's say, the stock market. When the market loses 500 points or 1,000 points in a day, it gets everybody's attention. People don't realize the same thing can happen in the bond market. It happened in 2013 when we went from 1.6% during the summer to 3% treasury yields as the taper tantrum began. It's happened in the Japanese bond market recently, where we went from super negative yields to less negative yields. So this is the world that we live in today that is a much more delicate, much more prone to having a financial accident than in the past, despite all the efforts that have been done since 2008 to correct the matter.
I would say this really indicates that these are structural problems.
Well, yes, and it's based on how our financial system works. Our banks operate on a fractional reserve system. For every dollar deposit, when they turn that into credit, they can increase that tenfold. And the issue here that you have in the banking system is banks, when you deposit money in a bank, it's a short-term deposit. It may be money in your savings account, your checking account, your money market fund. Banks take in their money. It's all short-term, meaning that you, as a depositor, can write a check, clean out your checking account, or you can withdraw that money in cash, or you can basically just take your money to another bank. The issue with banks is they use that short-term money to make long-term loan. Let's say they make a five-year car loan. They may be making that money with short-term money that's on deposit for only 3 months. Or they may make a 30-year mortgage loan, and they're doing that with short-term money. So the problem is, they are using short-term money to make long-term investments. That is always going to create a problem when there's a loss in confidence and it gets down to liquidity, because a bank has assets they make. We call them loans. It could be commercial paper. It could be loans on a mortgage. It could be loans to a business. It could be home equity loans, car loans, motorhome loans, boat loans, whatever it is. They've loaned that money out as a long-term investment. What happens when everybody at the bank says, oh, that bank's in trouble, they're lining up at the deposit window, taking their money out. The banks don't have that liquid cash on hand. And that's how you get a bank run. That's how you get a bank crisis. That's how you get a Lehman crisis. So it all gets down to the way the system is structured. And unfortunately, there are vested interests in keeping it that way. I mean, who wouldn't want to take a dollar and multiply it tenfold? And so banks can be very profitable when the yield curve is structured in a way they can make vast sums of money and profits through the lending system. But the problem is when confidence and leverage gets over-leveraged and there's a loss of confidence, then you have a bank run, which is what we've been seeing occurring with Deutsche Bank, although they are better positioned, much better positioned than, let's say, Lehman.
Well, if this is a structural problem, Jim, how does this get resolved at some point or another? Because tinkering around the edges isn't going to fix it.
Well, I mean, that was the idea of a central banking system, that anytime you had a liquidity run, this goes back to the early part of the 20th century when we had a banking crisis in the U.S. in 1907, where J.P. Morgan basically cornered a bunch of bankers in a room and he bailed out the financial system. So the idea with the central bank was basically they're the lender of last resort, so that when these liquidity crises arise, they come to the rescue, as we've seen the ECB do in Europe with the pig crisis, as we've seen the ECB do recently, as we've seen Japan do, as we've seen the Bank of China do, and our own Federal Reserve. But here's the problem. Our banking system is structured with short-term deposits and long-term loans. That's a disconnect. And it's just like most insurance companies or sound financial institutions will match their maturities to match their deposits. In other words, their loans will match their deposits. So one way to fix the system is require all banks that all short-term deposits must be invested only in short-term investments, so that if there is a bank run, then if they've got their money invested in T-bills or short-term CDs at another bank or something, they've got liquid assets. So if people want their money, they can get it. Secondly, long-term loans should be made with equity, not debt. And that's the problem. In Deutsche Bank's case, they're leveraged, their liabilities to equity, they're leveraged 24 to 1. So they're highly leveraged. So taking a bank and switching the system more towards equity than debt, because that's the problem that we have today, is we have too much debt at the consumer level, the government level, the corporate level. And then the other thing is, in terms of, let's say, central bank lending, the bank should have a what I call class AAA type assets that could be used and pledged on reserve, saying that, hey, if I ever get in trouble, here's a tranche of assets, all AAA rated, that the central bank could have access to as collateral to make those liquidity loans to a bank, and indeed, if they need it. So, John, part of the system has to change. In fact, it was one of the things that Mervyn King wrote in his book called The End of Alchemy, one of the books I read during my August recess, when he talked about this very liquidity crisis that we always seem to face. Because when you take a look at all bank runs, they all fail for the same reason: lack of cash, lack of liquid investments. And the only way you're going to solve that is match short-term deposits with short-term investments and equity investments with long-term investments rather than leverage.
Yeah, but if you look at the derivative still, $650 trillion of, that's better than the national debt, you know? And that's like leverage on steroids.
Well, I mean, there's a way to solve that too. One would be eventually to put derivatives on the exchange and put up capital to, just like you do in a futures contract. If I go out and buy a futures contract on, I don't know, a commodity, I could buy a futures contract on gold, the S&P, I put down 10%. That's my equity. It's listed on the exchange so that we know the value of the contract. It would be moving these derivatives to an exchange where they can be monitored in capital ratios, where if your derivative position starts to lose value, just like in a futures contract, you know, your broker or the exchange is going to call you up and either force you to come up with more capital, or you're going to have to liquidate that position. And the problem is almost 90% of all these derivative contracts are in some way or another tied to interest rates. And that's where the real issue is here, because what are we dealing with? We're dealing with the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. And at some point, that interest rate environment is going to change. And what it does, God help us if we haven't prepared for it. So the thing about what we're seeing as a result of these low interest rates, what is it doing? It's encouraging risk taking. In other words, people are going and investing in riskier assets that are less liquid. And this is especially a problem for bond ETFs and bond funds, many of which are sitting there. Some of the big bond funds like Vanguard and some of the others are sitting on assets. 50, 60% of their asset portfolio is illiquid. What do they do if everybody wants to get out at the same time? They won't have the liquid assets just like a bank. So it's not just the banks that we're talking about. We're also talking about a lot of these ETFs and bond funds. And the problem only occurs, John, when confidence is lost in the system. When investors say, I've lost confidence. I mean, think back of what it was like between the fall of 2008 and the spring of 2009, where every Monday the Treasury Secretary would come on and with some new alphabet program to bail out the system. The commercial paper market locked up. Nobody wanted to lend. People were defaulting on their derivative contracts. So it was a loss of confidence. And when everybody wants out, these assets aren't liquid. And if you try to liquidate them when there's not many buyers, these assets drop precipitously, which is what we've seen with Deutsche Bank, which has lost 65% of its value in the period of 12 months and rather rapidly. So assets can shrink rather rapidly. So you think you have a dollar's worth of assets, but when you go to sell it, you find out you don't get a dollar, you get 60 cents, 50 cents, or even 20 cents. So all of a sudden, your equity value or what you think is your equity evaporates, and that's how you get a financial crisis. And the problem is the only person big enough to create the liquidity is the central bank are the only game in town. So the next crisis, I mean, one of the reasons why the market's doing well today in Deutsche Bank is, gosh, there's going to be a liquidity tap here. And that could be either shareholders. The bank is forced to tap the equity markets with additional share equity, which would strengthen its balance sheet, or the ECB steps in or the German government steps in to backstop the system.
But as we said before, Jim, you know, this is a systemic problem. And a lot of times, both politicians and people inside the banking systems like to act as if we can solve this by more regulations or tinkering around the edge. And if you look, really, what has changed over the last decade? Nothing's gotten better. It's been 8 years since the crisis back in 2007, 2008. And we just keep rolling from crisis to crisis, which means that the fundamental reforms necessary and changes really aren't occurring.
Well, this really goes back to the beginning of the Greenspan Fed back in 1987. I think Greenspan became Fed chairman in August of that year. And then here it was, October of 1987, he had the stock market crash. And one of the things that was formed as a result of the stock market crash was the president's working group on financial markets, or what we know as the Plunge Protection Committee. And the Fed set up a war room, and it was literally lending billions of dollars to Wall Street to buy stock index futures to stem the tide, in which they did. I mean, in between Friday, the day before the crash, the day of the crash, the markets lost 30%. So had they not stopped that, it's just like anything else. It's like a spiral. It's like a snowball that gathers momentum as it's rolling down a hill. So central banks today are engaged in monetary manipulation through whatever programs you want to call it, whether it's quantitative easing, ZERP, zero interest rates, Operation Twist. And what it's doing, though, over the years, it's been distorting the mechanisms of the markets. In other words, if you look at what we've been talking about here on the show over the last couple of years, what do we talk about? We talk about the Fed, QE1, QE2, QE3, Operation Twist. Are they the taper? Are they going to raise? Are they not going to raise? And so the market is not being driven as much by fundamentals anymore, as we're moving more towards a market that we really don't have free markets in this country or a free enterprise system. People are saying capitalism doesn't work. We haven't had pure capitalism. We've had government intervention through regulation, taxation, and also monetary policy that is controlling the markets. And the last 7-8 years, all we do is focus on central bank policy, beginning here with the Fed, Then it shifted over to the ECB. Then it shifted over to Japan. Now it's back to the ECB. And now it may be China. So if you look at every crisis we have faced, beginning in 1987, the stock market crash. Beginning in 1997, the Asian crash. 1998, long-term capital management, Russian debt default. 2001, the bursting of the tech bubble. 2007 to 2009, the great financial recession. And since then, the ECB, the pig crisis in 2011, 2012. We've had one of these crises every single year, John. In the common response, Brexit, what did the Bank of England do? Flooded the markets with liquidity. Why are the markets up on Friday? Because it is felt that the markets, either the ECB, the German government, or the bank itself will tap the equity markets. So the problem when you have these situations is you run into what many call a Minsky moment. And that Minsky moment deals with the economist Hyman Minsky in his book, Unstable Economy. His financial instability thesis goes like this. The better things get, the better they are expected to continue to be. What are our economic forecasts, whether on the market or the economy? They're usually linear extrapolations of what went on the previous year. So human beings tend to extrapolate current conditions indefinitely into the future. We have low interest rates now. We're extrapolating there'll be low interest rates well into the future. Now, based on that assumption that positive economic conditions will continue, low interest rates will continue, people let their guards down with respect to risk, which leads them to take more of it. And as each individual takes more risk, the overall riskness of the system increases. And this is really not economics. This is just human behavior. And Minsky talked about there were three kinds of phases. Writing in his Stabilizing Unstable Economy, talks about hedge finance, where the economic actors expect cash flow from their business operations to be sufficient to meet their obligations now and in the future. Then we move to speculative finance, where economic actors do not expect cash flows to be sufficient to meet their obligations, especially their short-term ones. In this phase, actors have to roll over their existing debt in order to remain solvent. We've come out of that phase, and then you get into what we call Ponzi finance, which involves a situation where the economic actors know they're not going to be able to meet their cash obligations through operations and will have to borrow to meet them. In this phase, additional debt must be raised in order to retain solvency, or in this case, it should be equity. And John, that's where we've come from and why these crises keep reoccurring, and now more frequently because the world is more leveraged fourfold today than what it was in 2008.
So, Jim, as I'm listening to you describe this, that we're not really getting it under control, we have future consequences from this system as it's acting right now. What do you foresee?
We're going to have another financial crisis, and we'll get into that in the big picture part two today, but it's going to be different than what people are expecting and where it's going to occur because, number one, we're dealing with more debt. Number two, the financial markets have become less liquid, and especially the banking system, as a result of regulation. So what do we need to resolve this? We need to deleverage. Number two, we need to get derivatives moved from illiquid positions in lack of transparency to an exchange. We need to monitor counterparty risk, just like we do in the futures market. The exchanges monitor the people that are involved in these contracts. When your position starts to go against you, you get a margin call. And if you can't meet your margin call, your position is liquidated. And we also need to increase collateral of our financial institutions and match liabilities with assets, so that if a bank takes in most of its money short term on deposits, its investments with those deposits are short term, so it has the liquid cash to meet a run on the bank or a demand for cash should confidence be lost. Secondly, banks need to make loans from equity rather than debt. And the tax system needs to be changed because our tax system today, if you're a company, if you're an individual, you get a tax write-off if you borrow money. If you own a home, you have a mortgage, your mortgage interest is tax deductible. If you are a corporation, and you borrow money in the debt market, your interest payments on that debt are deductible. If you raise equity and pay dividends, all of that is taxable. So the tax system has to change. The problem is, John, this system is so complex that large institutions don't even understand the risks they themselves are exposed to. In the famous words of Chuck Prince, when the music is playing, we have to get on the floor and dance. Well, I mean, just as we saw a couple of years ago with J.P. Morgan and the London whale trade, where they lost $6 billion, nobody at the top knew of that trade. And years before that, Barings Bank with Nick Leeson's trades. So the issue is we are creating an over-leveraged system. And that system is reliant on central banks as being the lender of last resort, or in many ways, putting a put. In other words, I don't need to worry. I can do something foolish. I can take risk and I don't worry because the central banks will bail me out. And the problem is the global financial system, which was paralyzed between September of 2008 and the spring of 2009, it took unimaginable resources to resuscitate it. And what we've seen every single year since then, each succeeding financial crisis of the last three decades has been more severe than the last one that preceded it. And these things are growing exponentially, distorting the economy in so many profound ways. I mean, that's what negative interest rates do, or zero interest rates do. They distort the way you value things, the way you structure things. And so, John, the problem that we have, and here's what we're dealing with, and we're going to be dealing with it after the elections, and we'll get into that in the next section. But it's not an easy thing for the Fed to do, because what the Fed does influences not only interest rates here, but abroad. As the financial conditions begin to tighten, if the Fed does, what happens? The dollar appreciates. When that happens, credit spreads widen, as we saw at the beginning of the year when junk bond yields got up to 10%. Third thing that happens is volatility increases, so the VIX rises, equity prices fall, and the yield curve flattens. The Fed backs off, the dollar depreciates, credit spreads tighten, the VIX falls, equity rise, and yet the yield curve steepens. So there's a chain reaction and loop to all of this. And although I don't think the ECB or the Fed would allow another Lehman moment to take place, the Fed inadvertently may be creating the next crisis by its insistence on gradually tightening interest rates at a time that is really, the world is so susceptible to another financial crisis. And the next crisis, as a result, I think, is more likely to occur overseas, either Europe, China, or Japan.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is William White. He is the chairman of the Economic and Development Review Committee at the OECD, also the former chief economist at the Bank for International Settlements, and he speaks with us today to provide his personal views on the global situation we currently face. Bill, you've just been awarded the Distinguished Adam Smith Prize by the National Association of Business Economists. I want to say congratulations for that.
Thank you.
But what's interesting is that this award has also been given to Ben Bernanke, current Fed Chair Janet Yellen, and a long list of other highly influential economists that have really stressed the importance of monetary policy in shaping the economy for good. However, your prize lecture, which was just given weeks ago, it seems to offer a bit of a different view, and one where monetary policy has been guided what you refer to as flawed theory. Do you mind telling our audience a little bit about the message that you just gave only weeks ago?
I should note just in beginning that, yeah, there have been people like Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen and even Paul Krugman who got this prize in the past. But as I ran down the list, There's quite a number of mavericks that have won this thing in the past, too. George Soros got it just a few years ago. Henry Kaufman a while back. You remember him? Dr. Doom? Ken Rogoff, who's sort of somewhere in the middle. So they seem to have a sort of a fairly eclectic view of who's made a contribution and who hasn't, but who has made a special contribution. The basic message of my lecture, I think, is that we've been into this central bank easing since about 2007, 2008. And my sense of it is that the early stuff that was done by the central banks was absolutely spot on. I mean, it was designed to restore financial stability, particularly after the Lehman's crisis. And the central banks did all sorts of stuff, and I think it was totally correct what they did. But then around sort of 2009, and particularly with sort of QE in the States, remember in 2010, Ben Bernanke made a number of speeches. What became obvious was that the purpose of the exercise of this ultra-easy monetary policy was no longer sort of restoring financial order. It was a quite different thing. It was using monetary policy to stimulate aggregate demand, okay, to get the economy going again. And my paper basically says two things. One, it's not going to work. Even in the U.S., and I think we've seen this, even in the U.S., there's been a very subpar recovery. And elsewhere, it's often been significantly worse. Some countries nowhere near the level of output that they'd achieved before the crisis. So item number one, it should not have been expected to work, and it hasn't worked, okay, to stimulate aggregate demand. The second thing is that I feel, and I try to document this in the paper, that there's a large number of undesirable side effects arising from this totally unprecedented setting of monetary policy. And these side effects we've seen in the advanced market economies. We're seeing it increasingly in the emerging market economies. And I can go into the details of this later if you want, but the central point is that I see a kind of curve that basically says the efficiency of monetary policy goes down with time. And the harmful side effects of policy go up with time. And at some point, those two curves intersect, and the central banks are doing more harm than good. And my feeling is that this has been the case for quite some period of time. More recently, there seem to have been a growing number of people who seem to agree with me. So that's the basic message, more harm than good. And we must pass the baton to the governments, who are the only people that can resolve what is effectively a global solvency crisis. If it were a global illiquidity crisis, the central banks could do it, but it's not. It's a solvency crisis. So that's basically the main message of the paper. And lots of detail, of course, about the reasons why it won't work to stimulate aggregate demand. Not saying it won't work at all, but it won't work with the strength expected. And all sorts of detail about what those unexpected and undesirable side effects are. And I think they're very substantial, and they're far too little recognized by most people who are thinking about these problems.
And welcome back to The Big Picture, everybody. Wanted to remind you that the PFS Group Financial Strategy Seminar for 2016 is coming up on Saturday, October 29th, from 8:30 to approximately 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon. The location is going to be in San Diego at the Marriott Del Mar. And if you want to reserve seating for that, please contact Crystal Kessler. You can call 888-486-3939. That's in the continental U.S. 888-486-3939. Or just email Crystal, C-R-Y-S-T-A-L, at paplava.com. So that's an important one coming up. If you would like to attend that, again, October 29th from 8:30 in the morning to approximately 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon. You know, Jim, the last 3 months, we have been pointing here on The Big Picture to an economy which is very clearly decelerating, especially if we look at the leading economic indicators. What is really interesting, in having had the bad judgment to watch the presidential debate this week, which I describe as 90 minutes of sniping interrupted by little bibbits of truth, given the presidential elections that we're facing right now, and the fact that the president, he or she, whomever is elected, is going to be held accountable for the financial crises that are to follow in the next 4 years, everything we've been talking about, this decelerating economy, that is absent from discussion here in the presidential debates and in other areas of the campaign. So give me a framework for describing why you think the economy is decelerating. And I guess in the media, we're worried about beauty contests and things like that. It is amazing. It is. And I guess maybe the answer is people don't understand a lot of what we're discussing. And so they'd rather talk about beauty things, even if they're not going to determine the direction of things.
Well, it's the bias of the media. And have you noticed that this whole campaign is he said, she said? Rather than talk about the issues, but let's just do a quick rundown. I mean, if you take a look at private sector GDP, the 12-month rate of change stands at roughly about 1.3%. That rarely has happened since 1968 without coinciding with a recession. Industrial production, 6-month moving average, 12-month rate of a change has been negative for a good while. That hasn't occurred outside of a recession. Non-financial profits, down since 1950s. They've always been occurring right before a recession. Capital spending, the 2-year rate of change is negative. This situation always has coincided with a recession, and one of the things that has really been absent to a large degree in this economic recovery. New home building permits, 12-month rate of change has swung negative. Exports, 6-month moving average, a 12-month rate of change has gone negative. Industrial sales year over year is in negative territory. Tax receipts for 6 months will be interesting because the government's fiscal year ended on Friday, September 30th, and so we'll be getting those numbers. Employment variations on a 12-month basis remain positive, but they are trending lower. Consumer spending is roughly about 1% year over year. It's up 2%. So that really is not a good thing to see because it's mainly the U.S. economy. And John, we can just go to some of the numbers that we've seen take place this week. And it began with durable good orders, which have been flat. It began with housing. Pending sales have been down 3 out of the last 4 months. Existing home sales are down 2 consecutive months in a row. And not only when you look at things as big as autos, which are slowing down, durable goods have been down 6 out of the last 12 months, down 2 out of the last 4. So what is really amazing here is all of these trends. Like I said, you know, we get economic numbers every single month, and nobody pays much attention to the other than the big ones, which are really the unemployment rate. But the other numbers, if you have 1 month that it's down, whether it's the PMI, the ISM numbers, people say, okay, that's 1 month. But when you start seeing things trending lower over the last 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, 12 months, now you've got a trend in place. And the thing is, you follow that trend. Where is that trend heading? Is it flat? Is it heading up? Or is it heading down? And what it's been doing for the last 12 months, in the last 6 months, that trend is heading down.
Well, you have two colliding worldviews if you watch the conventions or what's going on in the debates right now, and two very markedly different views of the economy. One is saying that we're on the road to recovery. You know, it was a hard time. We inherited terrible problems 8 years ago, but everything's robust and it's great and jobs are going up. The other saying is it's lousy and it's getting worse. So, you know, each one is spinning for their own benefit, but they're not really reflecting the real world.
Well, I mean, let's take the views of both sides. Now, let's look at the positive sides of the economy. Jobs, we've had 70 straight months of job creation. So that's a positive. The unemployment rate is down to 5%. Gas prices are down to $2.50. And remember, John, in the election of 2008, remember when oil prices got up to $150 a barrel? And then we were having all the crises in the stock market. And the median household income year over year is up 5%. So you might be able to see why Hillary Clinton is saying, hey, we've done a good job. Things are looking pretty good. So you got to give some credit for these kind of things. And it's one of the reasons why consumer optimism has been high. On the negative side, it's the worst economic growth record since coming out of World War II. The economic growth rate in this economy has not been 3 or 4%. It's averaged 2, and we're now in the 1% range. Home ownership is the lowest in 50 years. You would have to go back to 1965 to find home ownership this low. And even though income is up 5% year over year, if you look at wages today in real terms adjusted for inflation, they're lower than where they were in 1998. And then in addition, usually when you get an economic recovery, the job creation machine in this country has always been small businesses. This is the worst business formation of new businesses since World War II. We have not had as few businesses created as been in this economic recovery. So depending on what perspective, what political party you belong to, if I was a Democrat, I would say, hey, look, we've created jobs 70 months in a row. The unemployment rate was 5%. When Barack Obama came in, it was 10. Gas prices are below $3. When he came in, they were over $3. They're down to $2.50 now. And if we take a look at the last year, household median income is up 5%. So you can see why they're trying to make that case to voters. On the other hand, you can see why Trump could say, hey, this is the worst economic recovery since World War II. That's a fact. The economy's not growing at 3%, 4%. It's growing at 1%. Home ownership is down. Real wages are down. Fewer businesses are down. So, John, it really depends on what you're looking at and your perspective.
You know, one of the things that I've thought is interesting in watching a lot of these debates and some of the other discussion outside the debates is where the United States used to pride itself on, you know, the rugged individual, the entrepreneur, the guy who could build a business and employ a bunch of people and become prosperous that way. We seem now in a lot of the rhetoric to be denigrating success. It's very bizarre. We're condemning success and rewarding failure.
It is really unusual because if somebody's a businessman and successful, I don't care if it's Romney or, you know, some of the other Republicans, it was interesting even too in the Republican primaries. If you look at, let's say, Trump's competitors, they were all politicians. And I think there's a sense in this country that, hey, the politicians have been running this country and things aren't that great. And especially now, the real risk here is two diverging views of how to make the economy work. Taxes and regulation on one side, free markets and lower taxes on the other side. And the reason I think this is important is, John, I think, at least from the work that we're following, is we are approaching the high tide in the PMIs. And usually when you approach that, then it's on that downward slope. And as we've been talking about here, we've been seeing a decelerating trend in the economy and what that might portend for the financial markets down the road in a possible financial crisis.
Well, other than knowing, you know, if we look at the LEIs, other than knowing where the economy is going and obviously profits, that seems to be the emphasis of the show here for as long as we've been doing it.
Well, I mean, the reason we call them leading economic indicators, because that's exactly what they are. They're telling you where the economy's heading. And if you know where the economy's heading, you also know what's going to happen to corporate profits in the market. The reason we like to look at the LEIs is we have an LEI index of 19 indicators, and we can overlay that graph of LEIs with the stock market, and they pretty much are conjoined together. So the LEIs spike up, the stock market spikes up. The LEIs dip down, the stock market goes down. Because what are analysts thinking on Wall Street? Well, if the economy is slowing down, as it did in the first quarter and second quarter, what would you expect to see? Well, it's exactly what we saw when companies reported first quarter profits and second quarter profits. They were lower. So that's why we like to pay a lot of attention. And why I think this is even more important this time. In the last decade, China and the emerging markets were the world's growth engine. If you take a look at where China is today, the problems in Japan, the problems in Europe, the U.S. is the world's growth engine. And it's very important in terms of what happens to the U.S. economy. There's a direct correlation with our PMIs, our economy, and sovereign risk. When we weaken and we get into trouble, there's issues that arise for the rest of the world because of the multiplier effect of U.S. trade deficits with the economies of the world. And you can see this, John, as we've seen basically when our PMIs improve, the credit default swaps on sovereign debt improve. When our PMIs decelerate or decline, credit default swap spreads on sovereign debt increase. Think back to the beginning of the year when we had the crisis worried about China. Think about last year when our PMIs were slowing down. We had the China crisis in August and September in 2015. Think about the crisis in Europe in 2011 and 2012. So there's a direct correlation in terms of what happens in our economy and its impact on the rest of the world.
But, you know, Jim, if you look at these data, I mean, I know you're watching them. It's obvious that other fund managers are watching them as well. One would think that the Fed itself would be following this, but everybody was shocked last December. Remember when they raised interest rates a quarter of a point? And of course, all heck broke loose in the first two quarters of this year. And you know, right now, I think Janet Yellen's holding off just because of the elections, but it's got to go up at some point or another.
Well, I mean, here's the real issue here. Short-term interest rates are controlled by the Fed. What the Fed has got to be worried about is a loss of confidence, and the markets could raise long-term rates, which in essence would force the Fed's hand. So they've got to walk a very delicate act here. But if they start to raise rates, we've got that feedback loop that I talked about in the last segment of the big picture, where it starts to impact the dollar, starts to impact volatility, starts to impact credit spreads in the stock market itself. So it's not like they can raise interest rates a quarter of a point. We used to have this old rule, three steps and a stumble. And the stock market would be okay until after the Fed raised interest rates three times. This stock market got in trouble the first time the Fed raised the first time. They only raised interest rates a quarter of a point. So imagine, because you have all these bets that are going on right now that participants have. They line up on one side of the boat and all of a sudden the markets change. And then all of a sudden there has to be a readjustment. And these adjustments can come very quick. So it's a very precarious market and tightrope that they have to watch.
Do you suppose the Fed could possibly be looking at a policy mistake? I mean, just like we were talking about in the last segment, remember, where the Fed let Lehman go under and then that triggered all sorts of mischief. So could we be looking at some kind of mistake if they make a move again? So very similar to that.
Yeah, very much so. And because, you know, you take a look at the way the stock market works, is the stock market and the economy follow policy trends. When you see rate cuts or rate hikes, it has an adverse effect on the money supply, the availability of credit, inflation. So all of this has some impact one way or another through a transmission, either through the currency markets or through asset prices and eventually the economy. And the problem is the U.S. economy makes up anywhere from 22 to 25% of the world economy. We influence the world's growth through our trade imbalance. So what happens here in many ways gets multiplied and magnified through our trade balance and becomes a major stimulus to the world, where basically, if you take a look at, the U.S. makes up almost 43% of basically the imports of the world. And so we are absorbing a lot of the manufacturing, whether it's coming from China, Japan, Europe, or elsewhere. So the global structural trade problems that we have today is that many of these countries, whether it's China, whether it's Europe, whether it's Japan, are dependent on exports to the U.S. You take a look at commodity countries like Brazil, some of the emerging markets, or Canada. A lot of these countries are, in one way or another, affected by what happens in global growth. So we could impact a large segment of the globe. So it's not just the fact that the Fed's raising interest rates here. Its impact is global, as we saw in the first 2 months of this year when they raised interest rates in a quarter of a point and they said, hey, four more coming next year. And they thought they were going to be okay. And we saw that completely begin to unwind the last week of December of last year and then the first 2 months of this year. And what makes this a different is right now, John, the world is sitting on $200 trillion of debt, most of which, a good portion, a third of sovereign debt, is negative, meaning that the governments don't have to pay any interest, and a lot of it is at zero interest rates. So imagine what would happen if things begin to turn around and interest rates rise in this kind of a over-leveraged market.
So, as we look around the world, Dan, if we assume we're headed towards some series of crises, where would you say they are lurking?
You know, I would say if I had to pick three areas, I'd say the three top candidates are China, Japan, and Europe. I mean, if we take a look at China, China's dealing with major deficits. Its economy is made up of malinvestments, and it has heavily leveraged itself to come out of the financial crisis of 2008, as many governments did. So, and China is heavily dependent still on its export economy, and that's where the U.S. impacts China greatly. And take a look at what Trump is talking about in the campaign. Japan, dealing with an aging demographic problem. And by the way, the same thing with China, especially with their one-child policy, which is coming back to haunt them now. Japan has major debt issues, sovereign debt. They are already at negative interest rates. And like China, they are dependent on trade to the U.S. So the consequences in the next down cycle, as you can see, a number of things happen. Number one, the U.S. would be perceived as the world's safe haven. It's the largest economy, the largest financial market, the largest, most liquid market in the world. So you could see the dollar rise. The dollar rises. What impact does that have? It hurts corporate profits because a lot of the S&P 500 companies, the Dow companies, are international companies. A rising dollar hurts their foreign sales as they're translated back into dollars. What happens also as the dollar rises and we have a crisis overseas, where's that money going to go? Is it going to go to Europe where it's negative, Japan where it's negative? It'll come to the U.S. So we could see interest rates go lower and actually go below 1%, as my friend Gary Schilling thinks. We could hit 1%, and there's some that are saying, hey, we could get down to 0.25% or even zero. Also, what happens, the dollar rises, the U.S. economy, global economy contracts. I mean, the IMF just lowered its global growth rate to 1.7% for this year, and they've lowered it next year to 1.8%. So we could see commodity prices, a higher dollar drive commodity prices and a plunging oil prices. And John, on top of that, you throw the geopolitical crisis that we have today in the Middle East, Syria. Look what's going on in the Balkans. And the dispute now that the U.S. is having with Russia in Ukraine, or and especially with Syria. And then also look what Iran is doing and the troubles that are being stirred up in the Middle East. You throw all that into the mix, and then what China's doing in the South China Seas. I mean, the whole geopolitical landscape is a lot more volatile, and it's gotten a lot more dangerous in the last 8 years because the U.S. has receded from its global role as the hegemon.
It is an issue here in this country because there are two things that people seem to be concerned with if you look at the polls. Economy's number one, and global security is number two, obviously, in the face of increasing terror attacks. And they're only promising to go up. ISIS is promising us more of that. So you sense, if you're watching the verbiage in the debate, you're sensing this tension between the real world and reality and what the debaters are debating about.
Yeah, well, you know, so much of what we're discussing and even in actually the debates is so much irrelevant to the world that the next president is going to face. They're going to face a possible U.S. recession. They could be facing a possible financial crisis overseas and a financial crisis here as well. He or she could be facing geopolitical concerns, primarily in the Middle East, also in the South China Seas and also parts of Africa. So, I mean, there's good reason why people are concerned about it, John. But, you know, here we are talking about on this Friday of a beauty contest. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. The problem is, too, one of the other props that have kept this market up, and this has been an institutionally driven stock market the last 7-8 years, individual investors have played a minor role in the market's rise. It's mainly been corporations' buybacks, and the recent study came out this week showing that corporate buybacks and dividends exceed what corporations are earning. So this is not going to continue because corporations have leveraged up. So leadership is going to be critical going forward because there's two entirely different candidates that have a different view of how to make the economy grow or how to make it better. And this time, John, it's going to be a crisis overseas. And that's why I think, you know, it's one of the reasons why we've been so defensive here is because everything that we're watching and seeing, our anticipatory indicators are telling us we're hitting, approaching a peak. And that's going to be the theme of our 2016 seminar, which will be held here in San Diego on October 29th. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we close here. But it's one of the reasons why I think at this point in time, if you're an investor, you need to be defensively positioned.
Jim, describe that.
Well, I mean, you take a look at the system that we have today. We have cash, treasuries, short-term corporate bonds, gold, and defensive dividend payers, because you want to have cash, because you want to have liquid assets if something comes up and you have to deploy assets. Secondly, you want to have treasuries, because where is the safe haven in assets if something comes up? And the other thing we like is short-term bonds, because I don't like a lot of the bond funds and ETFs that are out there, because basically a lot of these funds are sitting on illiquid assets, John, that may not be liquid. And then, of course, if we get into a currency crisis, I think gold would be a position, or it's the ultimate currency. And then, of course, you want to be in defensive dividend payers that hold up in an economic downturn.
And Jim, before we go today, I wanted to have you address the seminar that's coming up in October and the items you will be covering, so people can sign up for that if they wish.
This year's theme, John, is called Approaching the Peak. Last year is the final innings. This time we're talking about approaching the peak, because that's what we think we're doing. And positioning one's portfolio defensively, you know, let's say the next candidate starts out right the first 100 days, comes up with the fiscal stimulus, Congress gets his act together, and then everything happens and we postpone it for a couple of years. But other than that, John, I think this thing is just basically taking a life of its own, and it's proceeding and it continues to decelerate. I mean, there's a few positive things, as we mentioned earlier, but there are a lot of negative things that are out there too.
And what it really means is that the outcome is either we go down into this downturn, or for some reason we delay it for a while. That would seem to be the two possibilities.
And that's one of the things we're going to talk about. We're going to take a look at our LAIs, what they're telling us, our anticipatory indicators. And then we're also going to be talking about how do you position? Because quite honestly, as we've talked about here, how many times have forecasters gotten it wrong? Wall Street, the Fed itself, and many of the other things that are out there. And so it is basically a situation that really nobody knows, because we don't know what the Fed's going to do. Will they raise in December like they did last year? Will the markets react adversely, as we saw in the first part of this year? I mean, so many things can change here rather rapidly. And John, we simply don't know. And that's why one has to position yourself, because the outcomes can change dramatically, as they have this year. I mean, we started out the beginning of the year, there were going to be 4 rate hikes. The market was certain on that. The Fed funds rate was going to be over, 1.25% or 1.5% by the end of the year. Here we are, still stuck at the same place we were last December. So a lot of this, John, can have a different outcome, and one simply doesn't know, because it's in many ways in the hands of policymakers. And that's something we're going to be talking about at our October 29th seminar. If you'd like to make reservations, because we expect this to be a full seminar, you can call our toll-free number. That's 888-486-3939, toll-free. So that's 888-486-3939.
And aside from what we're talking about next year, anything coming up on the immediate horizon we should be watching for?
You know, I think what we're going to have right now, the third quarter ends officially today, September 30th. The government's fiscal year ends today, too. So we're going to be looking at corporate earnings that are going to be coming out here probably next couple of weeks. So we'll have corporate earnings. We're also going to be looking for those continuation of economic trends. We're going to have third quarter GDP at the end of the month. We're going to have the unemployment numbers due next Friday. And then we're going to start the whole economic cycle of economic reporting over the next couple of weeks here. So we're going to be looking at those two trends, corporate earnings and the economy, all of that in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.